All right, now we are in Unit 3, and Unit 3 is about metabolism in general, in this first of the three chapters, and then the other two chapters are about specific metabolic processes, cellular respiration and photosynthesis. This is an introduction chapter, though, for metabolism. First of all, let's refresh our memories. What is metabolism? Right. It is all of the chemical reactions that are occurring in a single organism, however big that organism is, whether it's single-celled or multiple cells. And there are thousands of different chemical reactions in metabolism, but of almost no biochemical reaction that's part of metabolism occurs in isolation, just as its own reaction. Almost all of the reactions are part of what we call pathways. This is a biochemical pathway shown in slide one. In generic terms, this isn't a specific example, but what makes something a biochemical pathway is that it is a chain of reactions. It's not a single reaction. As you see here, this example includes three. There's nothing special about three, but it's some number more than one, some multiple number of reactions. And what I mean by a chain is that, well, you already know that any given chemical reaction converts some reactant into some product. In a biochemical pathway, whatever the product is of the first reaction is then serves as the reactant in the second reaction, which gets turned into another product, which serves as a reactant in the next reaction, and so on, for however many reactions there are. So one reaction feeds the next in any given biochemical pathway. Whatever D is the final product in this case. But the cell is running this biochemical reaction, whatever it is, because it needs D at the moment. Another important concept here that's illustrated in this schematic form is that virtually all biochemical reactions are catalyzed reactions. And so we're going to talk more and more about catalysis, or how catalysts work. A catalyst, in general, in chemistry, is something that speeds up a chemical reaction without actually being a reactant in that chemical reaction. Something that is a reactant, of course, gets changed, right? Chemical reactions change reactants into products. That doesn't happen to a catalyst because it's not a reactant. So the catalyst is reusable because of this. It doesn't get changed into anything, but something about the catalyst helps a particular reaction to occur. In other words, it helps the reactants, however many there are for that particular reaction, to get turned into however many products. And it's a big speed benefit. A typical catalyst, well, let's catalyst is the general term, no matter if any life is involved or not. For instance, platinum metal is the catalyst in a catalytic converter in an internal combustion car. There are bad things that get produced that you don't want to put into the air. So the catalytic converter converts those into slightly less bad things before they get put into the air. And it's platinum metal, which is why people steal catalytic converters, because platinum is more expensive than gold. But anyway, that's an example of catalysis, a catalyzed reaction. The platinum doesn't get used up, so it's as long as it's in good shape, it continues to work. In biology, the things that serve as catalysts are mostly proteins, in almost all cases, proteins. And therefore, we usually don't use the word catalyst, even though that's what they're acting as. We specifically use the word enzyme to refer to a biological catalyst made out of protein. So enzymes are proteins, and there are proteins that specifically act as catalysts. And the speed increase is usually millions at least. It speeds up the reaction at least millions of times faster than it would happen without the enzyme. Importantly, though, any given catalyst is not necessary for a reaction to occur, because it's not a reactant, as I said. But in biology, the reactions that are necessary to keep an organism alive are not going to happen quick enough to keep that organism alive unless they're accelerated by catalysts, specifically the enzymes. And that's why such a big fraction of your genes, which is correspondingly a big fraction of the total number of proteins that you as an individual are able to produce, are genes for coding how to make not just proteins, but specifically enzymes. A lot of your proteins are enzymes. This brings up another important point about enzymes. They are specific. And you can see that. That's another important thing about this slide. Each of the reactions here, three of them in this case, is catalyzed, but also they're catalyzed, each reaction is catalyzed by its own enzyme. That's what I meant by enzymes being specific. There is no master enzyme, in other words, that will work to speed up any of your biochemical reactions. It might seem like that would be nice, but actually it would not be. You would not want that to be the case. Because if you had a master enzyme, that means all of your chemical reactions would be happening. And you never want that to be the case. All of your possible chemical reactions. Because sometimes you want to turn reactions off, sometimes you want to turn them on. There are competing reactions doing opposite things. You don't want them both happening. So the more enzymes you have, which are specific for individual reactions, the more control by far the cell has over what is going on biochemically. Metabolism is controlled by enzymes. All right, let's go to 2 now and talk a little bit about energy. We'll talk much more about energy as this unit proceeds, because it's largely about energy. And energy has several different forms, like electrical energy or light energy or mechanical energy, so on. But regardless of the forms, there is kind of a dichotomy with respect to energy. Just like there's a dichotomy of cell types, there's two major categories of cells, prokaryotic and eukaryotic. There are two major categories of energy, which are potential energy and kinetic energy. You've probably heard these terms before. Potential energy is often described in books as stored energy. The word potential means that it has the ability for something to happen. So potential energy is energy that is not being used at the moment, but can be. Kinetic energy, on the other hand, is often described as energy of motion, or energy in motion, energy that's being used And that's actually what the word means. This K-I-N, even though it's not C-I-N, is the same root as in cinema. Moving pictures. Kinetic means moving. For instance, a mobile work of art that hangs and spins around is kinetic art. So kinetic energy is being used. Potential energy is stored, in a sense. And we can kind of see the difference between these two categories in slide two. Not only the difference between them, but we see the important fact that kinetic energy can be converted to potential energy and vice versa. This is happening all the time in the universe. So these people are around this diving platform with stairs. Well, a person doesn't just magically appear on the top of this platform, right? A person has to climb the stairs to get there, which requires energy because you're going against gravity. And therefore, by climbing, a person is converting chemical energy into potential energy, because the higher you get off of the ground level, the more gravitational potential you have. The more likely you are to fall, basically. All right? And the faster you'll get as a speed if you do fall from that height. So you're in a person who is climbing the stairs is investing his body with potential energy, storing energy that can then be converted back into kinetic energy if he jumps or falls off the platform. So it's kinetic energy being converted into potential energy during the climb, and then just the reverse, potential energy being converted into the energy of motion and falling, kinetic energy, on the way back down. Well, speaking of energy, this brings up slide three, which introduces two laws of thermodynamics. Thermodynamics is a branch of science dealing with energy transactions. And there are more than two laws of thermodynamics. There are actually four, but we're only going to concern ourselves in this course with two of them, which, by the way, are called the first and second laws. You might think that the other two are called the third and fourth, but actually these are called the first and second because that's what we put down on paper first, and then they realized later on, well, actually we need something more basic, but they didn't want to renumber them because these were already in place, so they stuck one in front called the zeroth law. So the four are the zeroth, the first, the second, and the third. The ones we care about in this class, though, are first and second. And the first law of thermodynamics is all about the law of conservation of energy. Conservation of energy refers to the fact that that energy cannot be created or destroyed. That's what it means for energy to be conserved. So there's a total amount of energy in the universe. Can't create or destroy it. But even though you can't create or destroy energy, you can both transfer and transform it. Transfer of energy refers to movement of energy from one body to another. And by body here, I don't mean anything biological. I just mean an object. Like billiard balls is a good example. When you break in pool, you're transferring energy of motion from the cue ball to the other balls. That's a transfer of energy. They are bodies in that sense. Transformation of energy refers to changing it from one form to another. For instance, this predator is eating this prey item. The body of this prey animal contains a lot of chemical energy. Energy in the molecules, which is, and whatever we have as food contains chemical energy. And some of that energy can be transformed into energy of motion, for instance, when this cat is running in the next picture. That's transformation. Or in photosynthesis, which we'll get to in a couple chapters, transforms light energy into chemical energy. So it's a change of form for transformation. All right, so that's the first law in a nutshell. The second law of thermodynamics has to do with entropy. And entropy can roughly be defined with a different word, a single word definition of entropy. It's rough, would be disorder. Now, one thing that the second law says is that the entropy in the universe is continuously increasing. The universe is becoming more and more disordered over time. And it can only increase in the overall universe. Another important implication of the second law is that in any given energy transaction, some of the available energy gets wasted, so to speak, as heat. By wasted here, I mean that it can't do any work for you. So thermodynamically, work is referring to movement of something more or less, using a force through a distance. And we'll talk about ways that work is performed in cells in a little bit. But the point here is that there is no such thing, you have a certain amount of energy, like chemical energy, for instance, from food, that's available. You can never put 100% of that energy into use to do valuable work. Some of it always is lost as heat. And another way of saying that same thing is that no thermodynamic process is 100% efficient. In fact, most are not even close to 100% efficient. For instance, using an internal combustion engine as an example, more than half of the available energy that's in the bonds of the gasoline, the chemical energy, is wasted as heat. Less than half of that available energy actually ends up propelling you down the road. In fact, so much heat is wasted so much energy is wasted as heat that you have to have a dedicated cooling system or the engine won't run for very long. It'll seize up. You have to have coolant continually cooling it. And similarly, not close to 100% of the energy that's in the food that we eat can go into cellular work. We're always wasting some of the heat. Every individual reaction in a biochemical pathway is, to a certain extent, inefficient. Now, while we're on the subject of thermodynamics, I want to define what a system is, a thermodynamic system, but sometimes we just say system. A thermodynamic system is really, can be just about anything, as long as you define it. All right, but you have the entire universe. All right? That's everything. And whatever you want to define as a system is fine, but when you do define a system, that separates the universe into two things. The system, whatever you say it is, which could be this room, it could be a cell, it could be a chemical reaction, whatever you define it as, that's the system. And then everything else, which collect everything else in the universe. And that everything else is collectively called the surroundings. So defining a thermodynamic system splits the universe into system and surroundings. There are categories of thermodynamic systems. Three major categories that I'll mention, which are open systems, closed systems, and isolated systems. An open thermodynamic system is a system that is able to exchange both energy and material, matter, with the surroundings. Yeah, an open system can exchange both energy and matter with the surroundings. A closed system is a system that can exchange energy but not matter with the surroundings. And an isolated system is one that can't exchange either energy or matter with the surroundings. Now, there really is no real thing, such thing as an isolated system, a truly isolated system. Yeah. Energy. Oh, yeah, energy, but not matter. Unless you consider the entire universe. The entire universe could be considered an isolated system. Right? But any subset of the universe, whatever you define as a system that's smaller than the universe, can't be truly isolated. We can approximate it, and that's actually what is the intent when you design a Dewar's flask or a thermos bottle, for instance. Trying to design as close as possible to an isolated system. Right? It seals off, so there's no matter exchange between it and the surroundings. And it's designed so that you minimize the exchange of energy with the surroundings as well, which is why if you put something hot in it, it will stay hot for a long time. If it were perfectly isolated, it would stay hot forever. It can't, though, because there is a little bit of leakage. Eventually, there is energy exchange between a thermos and the surroundings. So nothing is truly isolated. It's just a mental concept. A closed system, though, is more realistic, right? No exchange of matter, but exchange of energy. And an open system is important in biology because all organisms, all living organisms, are open thermodynamic systems. I say living here because if you define an organism as a system, which is no problem, you can define anything you want as a system, it cannot remain alive if it's not able to exchange both energy and matter with the surroundings. All organisms do that. They exchange things that have to exchange both energy and materials with the surroundings. So by definition, all living organisms are open systems. Okay, those are some definitions. Let's have some more definitions. Slide 4. We have some examples of systems here, by the way. Three examples in these picture columns. It's the same system in each column, but it's before and after. So it's at two different times. Another definition I want to give you, though, is the definition of free energy. Free energy is the energy available in a system. And it has the symbol G, capital G, which doesn't seem to make much sense until you realize that it's named after Gibbs. Sometimes it's called Gibbs free energy, but usually we just shorten it to free energy. That's what the G stands for, though. All right, now G by itself as a symbol refers to the actual magnitude, the value of how much free energy is available in the system at the moment. Okay? Well, I just said in all three of these systems, there's a before and an after, so two different times. And there's a value of G for each of the two different times, before and after. And also, it happens that in each of these three systems, the system is undergoing a change in energy, free energy, such that the value of G gets smaller. So G by itself is the instantaneous value at the moment of free energy in the system. But usually we care more about delta G than we do about G. And we've already talked about delta notation in lab, right? Delta notation is a change in whatever follows the delta. In this case, delta G is the change in free energy, which is not the free energy. It's the difference in free energy between before and after. And how did we define delta if we do it mathematically? What would delta G equal?
G1 minus G2.
Well, what do you say in one? Use initial and final.
So initial G versus final G?
No, it's G final, G sub F minus G sub I. Final minus initial. Just like when you measured your change in mass, right? For potatoes, it's final minus initial. That way, for the potato example, if you ended up with greater mass, the final mass final would be bigger. Bigger minus smaller would give you a positive number, right? A positive change means that you've gained whatever. In that case, mass. Similarly here, if the final G is bigger than initial G, then delta G will be positive. Now, in all of these, you're ending up with a lower G in the after compared to the before for all three of these examples. And therefore, GF is a smaller number, right? Smaller minus bigger is going to give you a negative number. And a delta G is important not only in its magnitude, its size, but even more so in its sign, whether it's negative or positive. In all of these cases, you have a negative delta G. And a negative delta G tells you that such a change is exergonic. I'll talk more about that word in a minute. Delta G also, though, tells you that the process, whatever it is that the system is undergoing, is spontaneous. So these are three examples of spontaneous processes occurring for three different systems. Spontaneous means that it can happen on its own. I should stress the word can. This brings back what I was talking about before about enzymes. A reaction, for instance, can be considered a thermodynamic system. Any given chemical reaction has a delta G value associated with it. For chemical reactions that have a negative delta G, that means they are spontaneous reactions, which means that they can happen on their own, but that does not at all mean that they're going to happen anytime soon. And in fact, most of the spontaneous reactions that are part of metabolism don't happen on their own quickly enough to keep the organism alive, which is why we have to speed them up. But the point is that a spontaneous reaction can happen on its own because there's energy in the system to allow that to happen. A non-spontaneous reaction, which would correspond to a positive value of delta G, can never happen on its own. Doesn't mean it can't happen, it just means that it can't happen on its own. You have to force it to happen by supplying energy. Okay? Well, none of these is non-spontaneous as we look at them according to the arrows. Non-spontaneous would be the reverse of each one. You can try this jumping off the platform as many times as you want. You're never going to fall upward. You're going down the gravitational gradient when you fall. And so, another thing I want to say about a change in a system to a lower G value, which is another way of saying a negative delta G, is that thermodynamic systems would like to attain the lowest G value that they can, because lower G values correspond to greater stability. If you're already on the ground, you're not going to fall very easily. It's much more stable than being at the top of a skyscraper, for instance. The second example in the middle here is this collection of particles. So we're looking at a concentration gradient here, right? At first, there's a steeper gradient because they're all concentrated in this area within the circle. And we've already talked about the tendency for diffusion to occur. Diffusion occurs, and that actually decreases the energy. Remember, I keep saying that gradients are forms of potential energy that can do something for you. Well, the energy that's used by spending that gradient disperses these particles. So after the diffusion, the system is at a lower G value, and that's a more stable situation. Systems tend to go to the most stable state that they can attain. And the third example would be a chemical reaction. In this case, we have a large complex molecule because it's made out of a bunch of different atoms, and it gets broken into several smaller molecules. The reason that is more stable, well, I should add that in all three of these examples, stability corresponds with greater entropy. Remember, I said that entropy is disorder, right? Each of these is becoming more disordered, right? These diffusing particles are pretty well ordered when they're concentrated. They're losing that order when they disperse. And this molecule is very much more ordered than the individual pieces it gets broken into are. Because think about these individual, well, think about the original big molecule first. It can move around in space, right? But since all of those atoms are connected to each other, they don't all have individual freedom. You break it into chunks, though, and each of these chunks can independently move, so that there's more degrees of freedom in the little chunks than there are in the big piece. And that's more disorder, which is more stability for the system. So each of these undergoes a decrease in G, an increase in stability, and an increase in entropy. All right? That's true for all of those. And those all are a consequence of having a negative delta G value, a decrease in free energy. Now, actually, I don't even want to switch there yet because I don't want you to pay attention to the graph until I get there. Let me explain some three sets of antonyms to you. Antonyms are oppositely defined words, right? Like up and down is an antonymous pair. Well, there's three pairs of antonyms that kind of go hand in hand, but they each refers to a different aspect of the system. So, first of all, when you think of metabolism, as we've already defined it, the sum of all the reactions, metabolism is the overall set of reactions. But you can think of it as a Venn diagram. That whole set can be broken into two sets that don't overlap. Right? Similarly with metabolism. Metabolism is the combination of two mutually exclusive, non-overlapping subsets called anabolism and catabolism. You combine the two, that is metabolism. But what's the difference between these two? Well, a lot of words have an and cat that are opposites of each, opposite prefixes, like anode and cathode, for instance, in electricity. And in biology, for instance, there are anadromous fish and catadromous fish, which are opposites of each other. They're defined as on the basis of whether they swim upstream to spawn or downstream to spawn. Cat means down, an means up. Anion and cation are other examples. Anabolism is the buildup of larger, more complex molecules out of smaller, less complex ones. So we build things in anabolism. Catabolism is just the opposite, which this third column on slide 4 is an example of. Catabolism is the breakdown of large complex molecules into smaller, less complex ones. Now, anabolism and catabolism are the noun forms, but they have corresponding adjectives. Anabolic and catabolic. This is why bodybuilding drugs are anabolic steroids, because they build you up. Okay, so that's one of these three pairs of antonyms, anabolic and catabolic. You use one or the other of these terms when what you are trying to describe about the system is whether you're building things up or breaking them down. All right? That's one aspect of the system. Another pair, though, I've actually already introduced half of it, or actually I introduced both, is spontaneous and non-spontaneous. Something is, a process is either spontaneous or non-spontaneous. It's just like a reaction is either anabolic or catabolic, not both. Well, you use spontaneous and non. You use either spontaneous or non-spontaneous as your word of choice if what you're trying to describe about the system is whether or not it can occur on its own, as I already was talking about. That's a different aspect of the same system, basically. But something you're describing something else about it. And then the third pair is exergonic and endergonic. Notice those share the ergon root, which means energy. In fact, there's a unit of energy called the erg. But anyway, endo means in, exo means out. So exergonic means releasing energy. The system will release energy. Endergonic means that energy must be supplied. You have to put energy in other words. And so these words are usually applied to chemical reactions as systems. All right, now those are the three sets of antonyms, but they correspond to each other. You just use them differently based on what you're trying to describe about the system. The correspondence, though, is that anabolic corresponds to non-spontaneous because anabolic on this third example on the slide would be uphill, right? Anabolic also correspond, anabolic and spontaneous both correspond to endergonic. Those are all associated with positive delta G's. Positive delta G means that the system is undergoing an increase in energy. Well, that energy doesn't just get created, right? I told you it can't be created. It has to come from somewhere. Namely, you have to supply it to the system to make that happen. And so we're making big complex molecules in our cells all the time. We're undergoing anabolic reactions. We have to, because we have to build those things. But it doesn't happen for free. We have to supply energy to force that to happen. And therefore, those anabolic reactions are non-spontaneous. They are endergonic. So you're describing the same system with all three words, but you're describing different things. Endergonic refers to what's happening to the energy, whether you have to put it in or take it out. Spontaneity refers to whether it can happen on its own or not. And anabolic or catabolic refers to whether you're building up or breaking down. All right. And then, well, obviously there's also correspondence between the three antonyms of those that I just mentioned. So catabolic corresponds to exergonic, which corresponds to spontaneous. Catabolic reactions are spontaneous. As a matter of fact, speaking of food as a source of energy, which it is, food contains fuel. Once we actually digest it into smaller particles to take it into the cells, it serves as fuels. Fuels get catabolized. They get broken down in order to release the energy that's in those fuels. And that is spontaneous, but that doesn't mean that it's going to happen on its own anytime soon, as I said before. So even our catabolic reactions, which are spontaneous, still need to be sped up by enzymes for them to happen soon enough to keep us alive. All right, now we can go to 5 and look at this graph, well, a pair of graphs here. These pair of graphs have the same horizontal axis, which is called progress of the reaction. It's really just time, right? There's a before and an after. Each system, each graph is a system. Each system here is a chemical reaction. And so there's before a chemical reaction occurs, you have reactants. After the chemical reaction occurs, you have products in both cases. The y-axis, notice, in each is free energy, which is G, right? Free energy is G. But G is the free energy at the moment. So there is a G initial before the reaction occurs, the G associated with the reactants, the energy contained in the reactants, basically. And then there is a G final, the energy that's in the products. And each of these reactions is undergoing a change in G. So there's two values of G, and therefore one value of delta G for each graph. But the big difference between the two graphs here is that the red one is an exergonic reaction, which you can easily tell by looking at it, because exergonic means energy is released, meaning that the energy of the system goes down. It's a negative delta G, because it's G final, which is this Y value, minus G initial, which is this higher G value, or Y value. Right? So when you have a decrease in G, it's a negative delta G. That corresponds to exergonic. The other one is endergonic, because you're ending up with more G than you start with, which is impossible unless you supply that energy to the system. Yeah.
So like a match? It's the first one?
Yes. So
a lot of people do,
that's right. And matter of fact, that's an example. Striking a match is an example of a combustion reaction. Combustion reactions in general are exergonic. And the reason they're so important is that that's how we actually get energy from our fuel. We combust our fuels, not all at once like a fire, but gradually by chemically degrading those fuel molecules, releasing the energy from them. Okay. That's actually kind of explained in this next slide, slide 6. Here we have, this is wrong, by the way. This book gets this wrong. I already defined what isolated means. This is not, this cartoon is not an isolated hydroelectric system. Why isn't it?
Because there's a gradient and there's like energy there.
That doesn't disqualify it as being isolated. What did I say isolated is? An isolated system?
It's like energy coming from like outside the system, from the surroundings.
Well, for a system, which is this, these couple of tanks.
It can't exchange matter or energy.
Right, it can't exchange matter or energy. So why is this not isolated? No, that's all happening inside the system. It's all within the system. The water, both tanks are part of the same system.
So is the because light is being produced?
Right. We wouldn't be able to see the light if energy isn't leaving the system, right? So it's not actually isolated. The book got that wrong. This is a closed hydroelectric system. But you have a beginning and an ending condition here. At first, in the before on the left, there is a gradient, a gravitational gradient of water, right? Because you have this tank that's fuller and this one is not as full. And since that's the tendency for water to fall, and since it can fall through this tube, it does. Once again, this is the concept of a gradient being a stored form of energy. A gradient is potential energy, and it can do some work for you. In this case, the falling of the water turns the turbine, which generates the electricity and lights the bulb. All right, it's put to use, in other words. But since it's a closed system, no water is being added or taken away. And therefore, it won't take very long for it to come to equilibrium. There's no more gradient here because both tanks are at the same water level, so there's no more tendency for water to move from one tank to the other. And the turbine will stop spinning, and the electricity will be no longer generated. Well, if this happens in a cell, it's a good analogy of a light bulb going out because that's associated with death. An organism coming to equilibrium with the surroundings means death. There has to be continuous exchange of energy and materials. So this does not represent an organism very well. No organism is a closed thermodynamic system. This one is open, though, in the middle, because it's the same setup, except that you're adding water and you're also draining it off at the same rate that you're adding it. And therefore, since those rates of input and output are the same, the gradient remains the same as long as you're doing that. And as long as there's a gradient, you'll still have water flowing through from one tank to the other, spinning the turbine, and you will still be generating electricity. That's more like an organism. All organisms are open thermodynamic systems. But it's not as much like a true organism as the one on the bottom is. This is a multi-step open system. And that's what I was saying before, just about 5 minutes ago, comparing the striking a match to how we use our fuels. We don't combust our fuels in such a way that all the energy is released at once. Because it would... A couple reasons. One is that it would be too much energy released all at once. It would kill us if it were explosive that way. And also, even more energy would be wasted as heat if we did that. The heat itself would kill us. Instead, though, we conduct our combustion reactions not in one overall step, but in many steps, biochemical pathways, where at each step a little bit of energy is released at a time, like these multiple steps. Notice that in this bottom figure, the overall difference between the first tank and the last tank water level is the same as the difference when you do it in just one step. Just like if you, using glucose, because it's the master fuel in cells, if you actually light glucose with fire to combust it, you'll release a certain amount of energy all at once. That would be like this. We don't do that. We change it from glucose to other things in between until it finally gets to the end product, carbon dioxide and water. But it's still the overall same amount of energy change, same overall delta G, just released a little bit at a time in manageable amounts. And that's how we can capture it more efficiently. I bitched about the clock 2 days ago. It looks like they fixed it. Is that correct? Yeah, good. All right. Now to 7. Well, anyone know what this is that we're looking at?
That is... ribonucleic
acids. It is a ribonucleic. Well, it's a actually not. I'm sorry. It's not actually a ribonucleic acid. It is a subunit that could be used to build a ribonucleic acid. What are the subunits of nucleic acids called? Right. If you're building a polypeptide, which is a polymer, the subunits are amino acids. If you're building a polysaccharide, the subunits are monosaccharides. But if you're building a nucleic acid, the subunits are what? Nucleotides. And that's what this is an example of. This is a nucleotide. Okay? Now remember we talked about nucleotides when I gave you as much information as I've given you so far about DNA. I said that each individual monomer is a nucleotide, but even a one-piece monomer actually has three parts to it. And all three parts are shown here, right? The three parts are a pentose sugar, and this particular pentose sugar is ribose. That's why you were correct in saying ribonucleic. If it were deoxyribose, it would be a DNA nucleotide, but this is an RNA nucleotide. Anyway, the three components of a nucleotide are pentose sugar, a nitrogenous base of some sort, in this case it's adenine, and then at least one phosphate. Well, the fact that to be a nucleotide means you have to have just at least one phosphate is ambiguous, right? Because you don't know how many at least one is. And that's why, even though you're correct to say that this is a nucleotide, it doesn't... If I just tell you that it's a nucleotide and you're not looking at a picture, you have no idea how many phosphates there are, right? And that's why a better phrase to use than the word nucleotide for this particular thing is a nucleoside triphosphate. Do you remember the difference between nucleoside and nucleotide?
A nucleoside is just the pentose sugar and the phosphate group?
No, it's just the pentose sugar and the nitrogenous base. So the gold and the magenta here, if those were just by themselves connected, that would be a nucleoside. And it describes this particular molecule, if you, instead of calling it a nucleotide, call it a nucleoside triphosphate, because that tells you you have exactly three, not some range of possibilities, right? Okay, now there are different nucleosides possible, because we talked about the fact that there are different nitrogenous bases, right? Well, this one happens to have adenine as the nitrogenous base, and any given nucleoside is named for whatever kind of nitrogenous base it has. So this particular nucleoside, if it were just these two without any phosphates, would be called adenosine. And therefore, this particular nucleoside triphosphate is specifically adenosine triphosphate, which is what ATP stands for. Now, ATP does double duty, has multiple functions. Because it can be used as a building block to make an RNA molecule, along with the other three kinds of nucleotides that RNA uses. Because remember, it uses adenine, guanine, cytosine, and uracil for RNA. So that's one use of RNA nucleotides. But this one particular, adenosine triphosphate, also has a very important side job, unrelated to being part of a polymer. Just by itself, it functions as the most important energy-carrying molecule in cells. Not just your cells, cells. So this goes back to what I was talking about when I said that there's many equally important reasons why phosphate is indispensable to life. You can't have any nucleic acids without phosphate. That's enough of a reason. But you also can't have ATP without phosphate. And ATP is used to temporarily store energy in all cells. The fact that it temporarily stores energy is why a lot of textbooks call ATP the energy currency of cells, by analogy with money, currency. And that's a pretty good analogy, because when you think about money, it's by itself, it's not worth anything, right? The only reason that money is valuable is because it represents something. You know, there's no one really works whatever job directly for that person's needs. housing, food, whatever. Right? The work, though, is your effort, the energy that you invest in performing that job. And instead of getting the things that you need in life in exchange, you're given money, which in a sense is storing that effort. The reason that's a good setup, though, is because money is versatile. You don't have to, you know, if you worked directly for rent, that's all, the only thing you could get for your work would be the ability to live somewhere. If instead you're given money, then you're able to spend that money on rent or anything else. A lot of different things are purchasable by the same money, right? So that's what currency does. It's a middleman that is versatile. So is ATP. That's why it's a good analogy to call it the energy currency. Because in cells, there's all kinds of endergonic processes, like anabolic reactions, when you need to build bigger things out of smaller things. That's endergonic, as I said. Any endergonic process, by definition, is going to require energy. And in cells, that energy comes originally from the fuels that cell uses. Whether it eats, like we animals do, or whether it produces that fuel itself, like photosynthetic organisms do, still is fuel that the energy comes from, fuel molecules, chemical energy. And importantly, no cell actually releases, you know, when fuels are burned or catabolized, they release energy. But no cell directly uses that energy released from fuels to drive or cause to happen the endergonic processes that they need to take place. Instead, the energy that's released in exergonic reactions, catabolic reactions, energy releasing things when fuel is burned, that energy, well, some of it's going to be wasted as heat. There's no way around that. That's part of the second law. But the usable energy that's captured gets put into temporary storage by producing molecules of ATP. That's like getting paid for your effort. And I said that it's temporary storage because these things don't hang around as ATP for very long. Shortly after they're built, they're dismantled. Just like, in a lot of cases, it doesn't take long after you're paid before you start spending that money. All right? But the nice thing about doing it this way with this energetic middleman called ATP is that the energy can come from different kinds of fuels and all pay off in terms of ATP, which then can be used to power a great variety of endergonic processes, including anabolism. So it's really versatile. Now, it's actually less of a good analogy if you think about it in terms of cash as currency. It's even better to actually think of it in terms of a debit card. Because a debit card can be deposited to and withdrawn from, right? ATP is like a high balance debit card. And that's because there's a lot of chemical energy in the bonds holding these phosphates together. These phosphate-phosphate bonds are energy rich. Well, ATP, when it gets used, in other words, spent to produce some, to cause something to happen, to release the energy, in other words, the energy is released by taking off at least one phosphate, the terminal one, the one at the end. And so if that happens, then you are transforming ATP, that adenosine triphosphate, into, in that case, adenosine diphosphate, ADP, which I think probably the next slide has. Yeah, slide 8 shows you the using of ATP for energy. So we assume that this ATP has already been built. And in this case, it's being spent. Well, you spend ATP, as I said, by cleaving off a phosphate. And what's left then is adenosine diphosphate. And then the phosphate that you cleaved off is on its own. Keep in mind, by the way, that P with a circle is a special symbol. P by itself means a phosphorus atom. That's not what this is. P with a circle is just shorthand for the entire phosphate group. So it's a phosphorus atom and 4 oxygen atoms in that overall functional group. Okay, now the P in a circle with an I subscript refers to inorganic phosphate. Why is it inorganic all of a sudden?
There's no carbon.
Right, it's not associated with any carbon. There's no carbon in this when it's on its own. Here, it's still the same phosphate, but it's connected to a carbon skeleton in the nucleoside, so it's considered organic phosphate. Okay, so that's how energy that was being stored, some of the energy that was being stored by the ATP gets released. And this is what you do when you need energy to power something. It's like spending some of the balance of the debit card. ADP, though, still has a positive balance, and you could use it again the same way, by cleaving off another one, and that would leave AMP, adenosine monophosphate, which would be, in this analogy, like a dangerously low balance on your debit card. You know, you get too low a balance, you might get hit with a fee. Well, if you have a lot of AMP in your body, that's a strong signal to say you're spending too much energy without recharging it. And therefore, it tells the body to start building more ATP. By the way, when you do use ATP, which is what's happening in this downward direction, what kind of reaction is that? According to the picture.
Hydrolysis.
It is a hydrolysis. That's why water is required here. Hydrolysis splits things, right? You're splitting ATP into ADP and inorganic phosphate. But importantly, this is a reversible reaction. We're just looking at it in one direction. This direction, though, going from ATP to ADP and inorganic phosphate, has what delta G? That's a negative delta G. You're breaking a bigger thing into smaller things. That's more stable, right? It releases energy. So you could call this exergonic on energetic grounds. You could call it catabolic in terms of breaking things down. And you would call it spontaneous because this can happen on its own. But you can force the reverse to happen. It has to be forced to go uphill energetically. Uphill, in other words, taking an inorganic phosphate and putting it onto ADP to form ATP, which is how you store your energy from the fuel, that would be endergonic, non-spontaneous, and anabolic. All right? And it's usually one of these two forms. AMP, there's always some amount of AMP in you, but usually energy gets shuttled back and forth between ADP and ATP. Those are the two main forms. think I might have just enough time for this slide. This shows you a specific example of how ATP can drive endergonic processes. So we have an endergonic reaction here, just an example. The specific example doesn't matter, but let's look at it. Glutamic acid, which is one of the amino acids, and ammonia can be hooked together to form glutamine, which the cell needs. And notice it has a delta G of positive 3.4 kilocalories. So you know from the delta G, just by looking at the value, or the sign of it, I mean, that it's endergonic. It wouldn't even have to be listed as endergonic, right? Positive delta G is endergonic, non-spontaneous. And so that's never going to happen on its own. The cell needs glutamine, though, so it has to build it. It has to force it to happen. Okay, well, look at the second row. Here you have glutamic acid and ATP as reactants. The ATP, of course, has three phosphates, right? If you take one of those phosphates off of ATP and put it onto glutamic acid, you form a phosphorylated glutamic acid, which is an energized version of glutamic acid. The energy came from ATP, though, because you cleaved off one of its phosphates. So what's left of the ATP is now ADP. The phosphate is on the glutamic acid. All right? Once you have an energized version of glutamic acid, a phosphorylated version, then it can combine with ammonia to form glutamine, which is what you want, and the phosphate will be stripped off, and it's just now on its own as an inorganic phosphate. On the bottom, you have the balance sheet, energetically speaking, which is why this works. Okay, here is the reaction. This is just in symbols. It's the same reaction as shown in cartoon form at the top. Glutamic acid and ammonia form glutamine with a delta G value of positive 3.4. This middle one is ATP getting dephosphorylated. That's how we spend ATP, by dephosphorylating it, stripping it of a phosphate. So ATP going to ADP, an inorganic phosphate, that reaction has a delta G of negative 7.3. The hydrolysis of ATP, dephosphorylation of ATP, is exergonic. That's when we get the payoff for using it, right? And therefore, when you couple these two reactions, one endergonic and one exergonic, then the overall system, the combined system, has a delta G, which is the sum of the two individual delta Gs. And if you add 3.4 and negative 7.3, you end up with a negative 3.9. By coupling them into one system, you make the overall system have a negative delta G, which is spontaneous and exergonic and can happen on its own. This is how we force endergonic processes to happen. By coupling them with exergonic processes, often the exergonic process is the splitting of a phosphate from ATP to provide that energy. Now, what if the hydrolysis of ATP had a delta G of negative 3.4. In other words, exactly what the other reaction requires. Would it happen?
I feel like it could.
Well, if it were negative 3.2, obviously it wouldn't be enough, right? But what if it's exactly the right amount? It's still not going to happen. Why? Yeah.
Second law of thermodynamics.
Right. You can never get 100% of the energy put to work. You're always going to lose some as heat. And so, yeah, it has to be. But that's no problem here because it's negative 7.3, way more than you need for the positive 3.4. Okay, let's stop there. Thank you.